Hello and welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I am honored to be joined by Hal Blaine disciple, Mike McGaffin. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Bart.
It is a pleasure to have you here. Hal Blaine has been, the fact that we're 165 episodes deep and there's no Hal Blaine episode is a tragedy, but today we're going to change that because, he is iconic. He is one of the most recorded drummers in history, but really like the definition of like a working drummer in the, in the early days of rock and roll and all this stuff and commercials. And it's just so cool. Now, before we start, I want to say thank you to Raphael Zimmerman in Switzerland, because he's been on me for a while to get this going, and we had to find the right person. And that is you, my friend.
Thank you.
Mike, you drum teched with Hal. You've worked with him. You were on the team with him and Rick Fauché. But before we jump in, let's hear a little bit about what made you aware of Hal and what got you really into Hal Blaine, as a drummer and a person and a friend.
Okay. Like, it starts off in Don Mills, Ontario, a suburb of Toronto, which is now Canada's largest city. I was the oldest of four kids, so I knew what was going on. And I saw that night in 1964 with the Beatles and Ringo Starr. No doubt about it. When I saw Ringo, I really got into the drums, and or as Hal would say, the drums. And then what happened is that I played sports, and I was playing baseball, and I was all sweaty. And I remember going to the Donwood drugstore in Don Mills, Ontario, the Donwood Plaza, and because it had air conditioning. I went in there and I walked around to get cool, and then I saw the record rack. So what happened is what caught my eye was Herb Elvin, the Tijuana Brass, Whipped Cream, and a very pretty girl covered in whipped cream, and I wanted to take a look at that up close. I was 12. I was starting to like drums. I kind of knew what was going on. And I had to wait for a lady to walk away because I was too embarrassed to pick up the cover. In doing so, I also saw another. And it was this. It was the Mamas and Papas' first album. And it's also been called the Bathtub Album because they're in a bathtub. And this is the newer edition. So the toilet had been blocked out, okay? And all it showed is really them in this seedy, seedy place in a seedy bathtub. So anyways, I'm looking at this album. I turn it over, and the first time I saw, as we Catholics say, his capital H name, and I saw drums Hal Blaine. Now, the only other name I remembered right from the get-go there was guitar, P.F. Sloan, known as Phil Sloan. Those names would stick in my head. And then from there, I would find out in a few years, like a lot of drummers, that my favorite top 20 drummers were one man, and his name was Hal Blaine. And then to take it a little bit farther, in 1967, we moved to North Vancouver, British Columbia, beautiful, lived up in a mountain, and the Monkey scandal hit. I had all the Monkey records. I loved them. The drumming was fantastic. I learned how to play all those Monkey songs, and I just loved them. I loved the Beach Boys. They're my favorite. The Monkees as well. And so, I love the Beatles, but there's groups ahead of the Beatles for me. So the thing is that what happened is I just loved them. And the Monkey scandal came out because a reporter, a female reporter, I think from Tiger Beat, or Teen Beat, or one of them, got into the studio with the Monkees and Mickey and Davey, and I found this on More of the Monkees box set, which I paid a lot of money to get. And so at that time, the name Hal Blaine came up, and I go, there's that name again. But I've moved right across the country. And then from there, that was the Summer of Love. I was already playing in my first little duel and stuff like this. And the name Hal Blaine, in those days, there was no names on the records, and the Mamas and Papas, and no session credits. The Mamas and Papas album was the first one, and it probably had something to do with Lou Adler, who was the producer and owner of Dunhill Records to put these guys' names on, like Larry Knechtel and Joe Osborne and that. So I was a fan. I was already playing drums. And then I started hearing more and more about this man with all these drum sets and how he would play in all the studios.
Yeah. Which that's like, so now we're getting into the Hal story, which we'll kind of, I think, reverse and learn a little more about him as a person and his background. Yeah. But I think there's a little bit of a, let's say to drummers and probably specifically non-drummers, there's a little bit of a, like, wait, what? The Monkees weren't playing their, you know, instruments, which that's an extreme case because obviously they were like a TV band and stuff. But like the Beach Boys, good vibrations. You would think Dennis Wilson would have been playing the drums. It would have been great. It's an interesting sort of secret that, you know, I'm sure Hal didn't care. He'd play on whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it is an interesting thing to think about that he was behind all this. So let's back up now. So Hal was born, though, in 1929, Harold Simon Belsky, as far as I know. As much as you can, you want to give us a rundown of Hal's early life, and then we'll get into his absolutely prolific career.
Yeah. Basically, his parents, of course, they were Jewish, and they had survived even before the Holocaust. They had survived Russia and living in, I think Hal's mom was in a part of Russia, and Hal's dad, I think, was from another part near the Polish border. And anyways, Hal's mother survived being chased through a field by a Cossack with a sword. And she survived that. I mean, she survived a lot. And of course, after near the end of the war there, they started shipping over people in cattle boats. They went from cattle cars to cattle boats.
Jeez.
Across. And, you know, they didn't know each other. Then they went both over. Hal's parents went over when they were about 14, and they ended up in Holyoke, Massachusetts. And Hal, they met there and they got married. And, you know, I mean, they basically lived in a ghetto, right? It was the slums. It was the ghetto. There were Jewish immigrants. So, I mean, you know, things were tough. They had a couple of, Hal's got a 10-year-old, older than him, sister, Marsha, and he had a brother, Ben, and another brother, too. And so Hal was the youngest, and he grew up in Holyoke. He got he went to a Jewish school, and then after that, but across the street was a Catholic school, and they had a marching band. Hal went over. Next thing you know, he's a Jewish lad playing in the Catholic marching band with the drums, as Hal says.
So, boy.
Yeah. So Holyoke was, you know, cold winters. They lived in places that you had to put coins in to keep the heat and to heat your water and stuff like this. So it was tough. After that, they moved to Hartford, Connecticut. And, you know, Hal's dad was working for like $5 a week. That's what they paid back then. And he had a store where he paired stuff, I think shoes as well. And it was right across from the State Theater in Hartford, Connecticut. So again, they're living in a ghetto, and things are poor. But, you know, Hal found that he would go, his mom would make him a lunch. He would go to work on Saturday with his dad, and he would go over to the State Theater. And there he saw Krupa. And there he saw all the favorite drummers that he knew and that he heard about. And he would go in there and watch. And then from there, he would, you know, go back, and his dad and him would go home. So, you know, he wanted to be a drummer. His older sister, Marsha, bought a very cheap drum set, but it was nice for Hal. You know, at around the age of... he probably had that drum set when he was maybe 10 or 11 or something like that. So off he went. And then the Connecticut had tobacco fields. And Hal's father had a condition, allergies to the stuff that's in the air, the pollen from from the tobacco fields. So they were said, let's move to California. They had family out there. They had, I think Hal's brother was out there. And you know, they were already set up. So out they went. And Hal took the train. The war was just ending. There was soldiers on there, guys playing cards, drinking and all that stuff. And from there, Hal, they settled in, they stayed in LA for a while, and then they went out to San Bernardino. And that's where he started. He went to San Bernardino High. He got in, he had his own band. Imagine that. He's running his own band at 15. And he had, you know, horns and stuff like that. And he changed his name, which is common back in those days because of, you're talking about coming in almost to McCarthyism later on and stuff like this. So he changed his name legally to Hal Blaine. That's what he was known as. And he had his kids' bands, and he was playing in clubs, and the rest is history. And that's where he started going.
Yeah. I think it's interesting right off the bat how he went to the Jewish school and then would go across the street and play with the Catholic band. That's just like kind of the story of his life is like, I'll play with whoever you want.
Exactly.
I'll play on whatever you want. It doesn't matter.
Exactly.
And he, like you mentioned, coming on the train and, you know, with all the soldiers and everyone's kind of playing cards. That's also something that we'll hear about through his life is like he was around a lot of like, you know, tough characters through his entire career. And,
yeah.
But he was a pretty straight laced guy. Like I don't, from what I know, he didn't drink much. He didn't smoke. He
didn't drink at all.
Didn't do drugs, kind of stayed out of it. But a lot of the people playing in strip clubs, doing all this stuff, people around him would be doing that. But I feel like Hal was just like, I don't know. Yeah, he could still hang out with the guys, you know?
Yeah. He smoked cigarettes.
Okay. Sure.
And later on in his life, he smoked cigars.
Pretty common.
So, I mean, but he didn't drink alcohol. And when he was a kid in Hartford, he saw the newspaper one day flash up, "Dope Fiend Krupa Goes to Jail."
Which, there's a lot of feelings about that, about it being a whole setup.
Yeah.
And not true. And I've brought that up with Brooks Tagler, who's the Gene kind of expert, and he's just like, that's not.
Yeah.
And in the Gene Krupa story, it's all blown out of proportion.
The movie, of course.
But okay. So that must have affected him as his gets busted.
It did. And Hal was, he used to call him funny cigarettes or smelly, funny smelling cigarettes and all that. But no, he didn't. And, he said he was a non-drinker, and he probably saw one of the probably the greatest things with musicians as he got older was the alcohol.
Yep, it's easy to do. All right, so he's out in California now. So how does he get going with how do we get to him gigging and playing and getting on the records and all that good stuff?
Well, basically, I've got his book here, which is the greatest book. It tells Hal's story. And, it's about a 3-4 hour read, and it's really good. So the best way to do it is say from San Bernardino, the war ended. And of course he's the same age as my dad. And Hal was born February 5th, 1929. My dad was born in September, 1929. My dad was too young for the war. Okay. And so Hal was too young for the war, but they had a lot of spirit, like, let's go as we got older. And so what happened is the Korean thing started, and it wasn't the war, but it was what was going on there with the North. And what happened is that, the U.S., because, they had lost a lot of soldiers, in World War II. I mean, they had millions that served, but they still lost, and the guys were coming back, and so they put the volunteer to join up into the army at 16. Imagine that, 16. So Hal and two of his buddies from the area there, San Bernardino, they joined up, and off they went. And I mean, again, Hal's book talks about going over in the big ship and the vomit I mean, I was reading it again last night, and Hal, I mean, I remember reading it, this part on an airplane and laughing, because Hal's saying they'd be eating after they could get their appetite back. And a man, another sailor or an army guy just shot vomit all over Hal. So, I mean, you know, so
wow.
And Hal said it when he slept, he was sick because everybody was sick. They left San Francisco. They didn't even get under the bridge and people started throwing up. So they end up getting there to Korea. And then basically what happened is that it was cold. They didn't have the clothing and all that stuff. And then after that, really, with luck, Hal went into the tracking, you know what I mean? Because the airplanes, the U.S. Air Force was flying over North Korea, or I shouldn't say that, but around the boundary there.
Sure.
And we're sending back pictures, troop movements and stuff like this. And Hal and the guys would sometimes go out in the field in jeeps and do the, like when people are surveying, that's what he did.
Yeah, one guy on one side, someone on the other. Yep.
Yeah. And really by chance, and they did run into about 30 North Korean soldiers one time, just popped up just like that. Just boom, like that. And Hal said they had a case, a 2-4 of Pabst beer. And he said he didn't know what to do. I think he told me once he threw out a pack of cigarettes and some of them were grabbing the cigarettes, but he didn't know. He thought he was over with. So the thing is that he grabbed the Pabst Blue Ribbon and started making a lot of noises. He said the guys left. So basically, but when Hal was over there, he got in very lucky to get into playing in bands and was given a playing for officers, even though he wasn't an officer. He was given a new set of Gretsch drums, White Marine Pearl, and all that kind of stuff, and all that stuff. So, you know, he started playing there, and then he didn't, you know, he could sleep. He was given better places to sleep because there was 50,000 U.S. Marines. And Hal thought of the Marines. His brother had survived the Marines in World War II, but, oh, it was... It looked a little bit tougher.
Yeah.
So not that Hal was a wimp, but he went with the Army. The Army was really recruiting and stuff like that. So, you know, after Korea, you know, they came back and Hal came on another ship and went back to San Bernardino. And then he used his GI Bill, which he had, and went to the Roy Knapp School of Music. And that's in Chicago, Illinois, right? So... In Chicago, he studied hard, but he was getting gigs like playing with strippers and playing in, as he said, he met a lot of D's, Dems, and Do's guys.
I've heard that, yeah.
Okay.
And he just fits right in, though.
Fits right in.
They like those types of guys, and he's even said, I was just listening to an interview with him this morning on the show, the podcast, I'd Hit That, which I highly recommend to everyone. It's Hal. It's a 2.5-hour interview. But anyway, he was saying, you know, he kind of said, I could probably say this many years later, I would be mixed up with mafia types. And
yes.
It was like real deal, you know, people getting hurt kind of stuff. But I guess Hal just, you know, did his, he drummed.
He played at night. He played till 4 in the morning. He got up at 8 and went to his classes. He got his father, who didn't have a lot of money, money into a hotel room. He could stay very close to his school. So, you know, and at that school, a lot of famous drummers, including Buddy Harmon, the great Buddy Harmon from Nashville, he went there as well. So, I mean, from there, Hal was like, wow, you know, he could read music. He's playing the different instruments, the marimba, you know, all that kind of stuff. And he's playing every night. And the strippers are telling their bosses, well, you know, mob bosses, really, that we like the way this swarthy-looking guy can play with the bright blue eyes, you know what I mean? Or Earl Palmer said Hal's eyes were pretty, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's
for
a
Earl
guy.
To say that, Earl's a tough guy, right?
Yeah.
So anyways, he had pretty eyes. So the girls all liked him. The mob bosses liked him. Everybody loved him. The way he played, he just kept learning and learning. And then one day he got one of those D's, Dems, and Do's guys came to him and said, I want you to come and play for this young talent. He's uprising and all that stuff. He's going to be the next Elvis and all that stuff. And Hal says, I'm really busy. I don't have time for this. And you know, Hal would be polite and stuff like this. And they said, well, we think you should really come and all that stuff. And we're going to pay you. And Hal said, well, I don't know. You know, he says, no, you show up. So he did.
You're doing it.
You're doing it. We're going to pay you. And he showed up. And it was the great Tommy Sands. They needed a drummer. And they did a little bit of jamming. And boom, Hal's in. And along with Tommy Sands, of course, Tommy Sands' girlfriend was Nancy Sinatra. Nancy was 17.
Wow.
Hal was, and Tommy was 19, okay? So Hal's already, you know, getting in his 20s there, right? So then he started his relationship with the Sinatras. And the Tommy Sands thing, they traveled around, they toured and all that kind of stuff. And then... Tommy Sands and Nancy split up. Some people say Frank Sinatra kind of put the kibosh on Tommy's career. So Tommy and Nancy divorced. They were too young, I guess, to get married, Hal said. But he said everything was first class. And Frank would say, Blaney, pick up the kid's bill. and they were playing at the Fountain Blue, that real fancy place. Of course, it was, you know, run by, you know, mob guys. Giacana was the top mobster back then. And so Nancy had a residence there, and Hal was there. And one day, and big Nancy was there. Nancy's the chaperone, Mrs. Frank Sinatra the first, right? Now, Frank was split up from her, but she was there. And one time at a breakfast outside, Tommy, Nancy, Big Nancy, and Hal. Busboy brought over a phone and said, you're Mr. Blaine? He said, yeah. And he said, a telephone call. Hal goes, wow, I'm in high cotton here, and this is all good. Sure. But it's Frank. And he said, Hal, what do I hear? You're my wife.
Oh, wow.
And Hal thought, it's all over now.
Oh,
it's all over now. He meant old Big Nancy, who he was split from, but I'm sure Frank was still seeing her, right?
Yeah, you know,
Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, you don't mess with Frank Sinatra's ex-wife. Yeah.
But then he started laughing, and he said, I'm just pulling your leg. And Hal said, thank God. So anyways, you know.
Crazy.
So what happened was then is Tommy Sands was pretty much done. Hal moved to L.A., and he was playing with here's a great name for a bar. I don't know if you could use this anymore, but the Garden of Allah. I mean, a great place. All the movie stars, Steve McQueen, Joey Heatherington, all the stars would go there. They played jazz, they played pop, you know, all that stuff. And so from there, he started poking around, of course, in L.A. He got in with Patty Page. And Patty Page's husband was Charles Curran. And he was, I think, Warner Brothers. He was the head of like a lot of the movies, meaning that he would do the music, hire the dancers, and stuff like this. And so, Hal took up with playing for Patty Page's show, and he traveled around. In fact, in Hal's house, I had in my hand one time a case with his timbales in it, and it said Patty Page show on it in stencil. So, anyways. Yeah. Patty Page in the movies, he was starting to act in movies. He had his card to act in movies. And then he was, through Patty Page, his husband, he started like playing on tracks and stuff like this. And at night, Hal was playing in the studios. Some of them were small studios. Some of them were in garages. He just went everywhere. And so he's working in those studios. And Earl Palmer told me, I knew Earl because of Hal. I've interviewed Earl, fantastic guy. And he called my house. My wife says, it's Earl Palmer on the phone. Holy, you know, like, wow. I mean, this is big, right? Hello. And so anyways, and he was just a great guy to talk to and all that stuff. And what happened is that because of that, Hal's playing in the studios. Earl told me that they wouldn't let the black musicians play in some of the studios. And they had their own union. Of course, Hal was in the union. And he's in L.A. now, and he's got Slingerland drums that he bought in San Bernardino. like the set, like, you know, Krupp and all those guys would play. And then he's got his first set of Zildjians, and he buys them in 1949. I think he bought them in the San Bernardino area, whatever. So he's still got those. He's playing in the studios. He's just having a ball. You know, he loves L.A. He came from the cold, the east, the cold of Korea. And, you know, and then they start playing, and Earl throws the bone to Hal. Like Hal would throw bones to. So, you know, Hal's there, and next thing you know, the guys were doing stuff for Sam Cooke. I mean, what a star Sam Cooke was. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bone thrown, and this is what happens. And suddenly, another Saturday night, that becomes a big hit with Sam Cooke. And it just starts going from there. And suddenly, then he's in with Phil Spector.
This week's episode is brought to you by Milestone Percussion. Milestone is celebrating 50 years of Canadian innovation and has been given a new lease on life by Ron Dinette. Ron has brought this great brand back to life with the extreme attention to detail and quality we've come to expect from all Dinette products. Drummers such as Terry Clark, Bob Ezrin, Jerry Mercer, and Gary McCracken are some of the Milestone alumni who loved these innovative and beautiful drums. Keep up with Ron and Milestone on social media at Dinette Classic Drums and on his website at Dinette.com. That's D-U-N-N-E-T-T. Yeah, and that, just that progression, it basically never stopped throughout his entire life. No. And I think we all know that he has played on hundreds and hundreds of songs. And just the sheer list of things, you've probably on a daily basis, most people, if they listen to some older songs, have heard Hal Blaine on a daily basis.
Every day, every channel.
Every day, every channel. Some things that I noted, too, that I want to mention, and we may get to it, but one thing that is interesting is Hal's, I believe in the interview I was listening to, he was in his 30s. He said right about the time when he was 30, he became a San Bernardino police officer.
Yeah.
And was passionate about, he basically always had a gun on him for protection. Yeah. He just was passionate about law enforcement and enjoyed having a badge, which is just such a neat kind of side to him.
Yeah, I've seen the gun is a snub nose, mm-hmm. a police snub nose gun, and a 45, they call it. Maybe a snub nose, whatever.
Sure, anyways,
we don't have guns.
I was going to say, up right? in Canada, so, it's different. I think it was a 38. I'm not a big gun guy, but I think it was a 38.
Police gun.
Yeah.
I've seen that, and I've seen his badge. And the way he got the badge was that back then, all the bars and nightclubs in San Bernardino, you know, a little bit of a tough area, right? Riverside and all that stuff. And, you know, on the journey to the desert. So, I mean, there between things that went on that somebody, they had to have, the bars got around having an ex-policeman or a guy that's moonlighting.
Yeah, like a plain clothes
instead,
policeman.
Yeah, instead of paying them, all they had to do is have a guy on the bandstand with a gun and a badge. Well, I'm sure a badge. Maybe the gun was in his whatever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So Hal got, you're the man. And off there. And he was very, very proud of that badge.
Yeah. And he in the interview I was listening to, told a funny story that was about basically something along the lines of like a woman he was seeing or friends with wanted to go to Tijuana, Mexico, and do something. And Tijuana has kind of it's famous for being a little bit rough. You might want to bring some protection.
There.
Yeah. I don't want to offend anyone in Tijuana, but that's just the connotation. Yeah, but so Hal said that he went to a pawn shop, a hawk shop, and he said that he bought a handgun that was illegally bought. He's like, you know, I'd rather buy it, and get in trouble for the gun than getting in trouble and getting killed on this trip to Tijuana in the 50s or whatever. He said years later, he had that same gun that he had been carrying that he got at the hawk shop. And then he said that he had to do something where he had blanks in it or something. He was just going to try and scare someone. And he fired six times and nothing happened. And he said that he realized someone told him then that the firing pin, I guess, had been removed. And this gun he bought for protection all those years ago was literally useless and did not work.
Yeah.
So the whole time it wasn't even a working gun. But and then he got himself a .38, a real big boy gun.
Yeah.
Interesting times, but good for Hal for, again, being, you know, I think he just likes, he would always say that he would like to go in this interview, he would like to ride and like do police ride alongs and just in towns that he was in, go see the police. And so clearly he liked that world of just law and order. I think it's kind of a trip for him to go do that and ride along with cops.
Yeah, yeah, of course, because he knew all the bad guys, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the people he knew, I'm sure, were, you know, it's just from the Chicago thing especially. And you know, L.A. is L.A. It's just a tough place, right?
It's a tough place, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so then, so Hal is working, he's chugging, he's on big albums. I mean, it's really happening. And I know, just whenever it might, I think it's probably already happening, but I had heard Hal say that the commercials were the easiest money. They were, he said commercials were the greatest thing. Obviously, I'm sure he enjoyed playing on huge albums, but he said commercials, you'd go in and, you know, in 20 or 30 minutes, you've played on it. And later on, you would make up to $1,000 a commercial.
Yeah.
And he said they would split them into 60 seconds, 40 seconds, 30 seconds, and make all these ads. And he said he was rolling in checks, which I want to mention. He said that basically it was falling into a vat of chocolate is how he kept referring to it, of like heaven. Yeah. Do you want to talk about the commercial stuff?
Yeah, the commercials were, of course, you know, even back then, you had many, many channels in the LA area. Even if he wasn't doing national commercials, he'd be doing local commercials, right? So, and you know, they were paying well, and of course, he was in his union. He was playing the commercials, and you know, later on, when he moved to Northern California, there he was playing for jingle houses and things like that, commercials, and he did those things where, when he got the monster set, he'd do all these rolls from his 8-inch tom to a 16-inch tom on his monster kit, and they would use those for the intros to radio stations.
Yep.
Many of them, and across the country.
Cool.
And then, of course, he started working in national commercials, and it was all because of the guys he knew. It was all the producers. The producers, you know, that, as you said, I mean, Hal had everything going for him, and he could play, he could read, he could, wouldn't cause troubles. He was a master comedian, and that's from hanging around with guys like Lenny Bruce. He, you know, in Vegas, you know, there's a whole area in Vegas there as well that, you know, was still owned really, you know, it wasn't the Vegas of nowadays, but he was playing out there for, you know, the Diamonds and Little Darling and stuff like this. But Don Rickles.
Yep, Buddy Hackett.
Buddy Hackett. Hal told me that he golfed with Buddy, and Buddy smoked the joint every hole. Back then. Jeez. Back then, Hal said he was scared.
What's funny, though, is how he says that, you know, in the interview I heard, he said he'd get a check every time one of those things runs, which I assume is a union thing.
Yeah.
Because I've played on, I worked at a studio that did jingle stuff a lot, and I've played on jingles that I see literally every day on TV, like three times a day. I'm not getting a dime. I got like $75 for the hour, and I'm not getting a dime beyond that. So Hal definitely had a sweet gig to be getting paid for each of these. You know, well, it's a different structure.
Here's how it works still today with the new use. That's something that Hal and all of them worked on. They first of all started getting checks as well. And they wouldn't do that before, but you know, so what happened is, like, Hal and those guys would, they had the, you know, the strong union, and still to this day, number 47 is from contracts signed from 1960 and up. So whenever I saw a TV commercial, I'm watching the American channels, even on the Canadian national channels, if I saw something, there was a Volkswagen commercial, and they played the, first of all, the Flintstones theme, the guy was at a red light, and then they played the Jetsons. And that's Frankie Capp, my friend Frankie Capp, who I met through Hal. So we made sure, you know, I reported that, and then they went after. The lobbyists, they would go after these big companies to pay. Now, I've heard Don Randy say that every second day he goes to his mailbox, he has a check. I mean, Hal would go every when he lived in, of course, where he lived in Palm Desert, he would always go. He had a P.O. box and he had a street address. The P.O. box, he would go and he would pick up his checks. And he told me one day Russ Wapensky said, "Hal, we got your money coming from Batman again." You know what I mean? And then Hal said to me, "You know, Mike, I got a check from something I did in 68 and it's being shot and run in Japan." So like, no, without these checks, as Hal said, without these checks, I'd be homeless.
Yeah, and they seem like they're substantial checks, because I think if there was an old Seinfeld episode where he was getting checks for like 2 cents for something that aired in Japan, and he got like thousands of them, and he hurt his hand signing them all.
Yeah.
These are substantial checks. I don't know if we're getting ahead of ourselves with his lifestyle, but how like he had a yacht.
Yeah.
Hal was a Rolls Royce fan, member of the like Palm Springs Rolls Royce Owners Club, which you don't really do if you're hurting for money. So Hal really did like the finer things in life. He liked doing, you know, having yachts and boats and Rolls's and things like that. So he worked really hard, and a huge mansion, which he lost a lot of this stuff, which is a big part of this. But he did great for himself. I mean, he was a rich guy.
Yeah. I mean, he bought Lee J. Cobb's mansion in, Bel Air, Beverly Hills area. And so he had never really had it. I mean, his parents never owned a house. You know what I mean? They just rented. And so, yeah, I know he had that. And one thing he always said to me was, "Mike, don't sit in a room and practice drums all day long. Don't." Hal didn't need the practice. And in fact, he says, you have to have other hobbies. What he always was interested with me is that I came from the car business. We owned a Honda dealership for over 40 years. And before that, we had a Volkswagen, Porsche, and Audi. And so the thing is, I grew up since I was 14 in the car business. We sold our Honda dealership 6 years ago, and now I'm fully retired.
Wow.
Being at 68.
Congrats.
So Hal was just, he loved cars. He loved the idea about business. And I still meet some of Hal's friends that go, "Are you the guy in the car business?" You know what I mean? So they always like that, because he bragged me up, right? Like,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
he just didn't, he always said, you know, like, I live on the water here. I've lived for 40 years. I can go to England. I mean, it'd take a long time, but I could head out to the Atlantic Ocean. And Hal loved boats, as he said. He liked, and anybody from that generation, a meal is the big thing in their life, to have a meal.
Yeah.
"Mike, I'm going to take you. We're going to have a meal." So it wasn't just drums and all that kind of stuff, but he'd talk about his favorite drummers and things like that, but he had other interests, you know, and he liked to sit around and smoke cigars.
Sure.
He liked to read. He just said, "Don't be just drumming." He said, "And not, don't try to copy people. You got to do your own stuff too."
Yeah.
Right?
And enjoy your life while you're doing it. All right. So where we kind of are is he's working really hard, but would you say, could you maybe put a year to where we're at, where he's working constantly? I don't know if we've gotten to the Wrecking Crew yet, but like
what
okay, decade, well, where are we?
Yeah, we're in the late 50s, okay? And so he starts, I got his discography. Well, I got a couple discographies.
Sure.
One he gave me over 20 years ago, and it's with the old computer print and all that kind of stuff, the names. And in 1959, Hal hit the first of the top 10s with Baby Talk. And that's it's a kind of a schlocky kind of a song. Jan and Dean did a lot of funny type of stuff. They thought they really liked Laurel and Hardy. So, and then 1960, so he's playing still on shows. He's playing the nightclubs in LA. He's playing everything. 1960, he loved Connie Francis. He said after the attack on Connie Francis in the hotel room in Atlantic City, he said she never recovered. Hmm. And that's a sad story. He got number 8 on that with Mama. And then 1961, he started hitting the jackpot. Number 1 song, Can't Help Falling in Love with You, Elvis Presley. And number 4 of that year, there again, Connie Francis from the great movie. This is my age. I love all this hokey stuff. Where the Boys Are. Hmm. And then, so in 62, I'm just kind of building up to where we're going here. So in 62, and just think that he's still doing, you know, he's still doing stuff. Like he's still doing on the, you know, he starts meeting Elvis. He starts playing on Elvis stuff. He starts being an actor in Elvis's Blue Hawaii. He was in that. And in fact, so 61, he hits number one with Can't Help Falling in Love with You. Number four, Where the Boys Are. So let's go to 62 and off we go. Number one, He's a Rebel. And that's Al DeLore, the great piano player on that piano. He's a rebel. And so, you know, it's the Crystals, of course, in the stable of Spectre. Number two, Return to Sender that year, Elvis Presley. And then, of course, number six, he played on some Herbert Albert and Tijuana Brass. It says in his book, The Lonely Bull, but I think how he played on the Lonely Bull album, because I know Earl Palmer played that song. There are some mistakes, and sometimes two guys would play the same song, right?
And they would use version two instead of
exactly.
version one.
Exactly. Now, nowadays, they can use 10 of you guys and cut you all up in snippets and all that stuff. You never know. Yep. So like 63, let's start jumping in there. Number six, Then He Kissed Me, the Crystals. Mm-hmm. Here's Sam Cooke. Earl had been throwing him bones. Another Saturday Night in 1963. Number 10, Be My Baby. There's Brian Wilson's favorite song, number two. And then he hits with the Beach Boys. Be True to Your School, with it's got that great marching drum kind of a thing. And In My Room on the Beach Boys album. Well, so we're still in 1963. So number three, the Do Run Run. I mean, number 10, Drag City for Jan and Dean. Number 10, 18 Yellow Roses with Bobby Darin, which I just read on Hal's face page thing run by a lovely woman named Ingrid, that a young Jim Gordon played the hi-hat that song.
Huh, that's interesting.
Well, Hal played a steel drum.
Okay. So much history.
So he was carrying a young drummer with him who, as a teenager, played in world tours with the Everly Brothers. And jeez, that's the awesome, the one and only James Beck Gordon.
Yes.
Known as Jim Gordon.
Who deserves his own whole episode down the road.
I can give you that. Friend of mine went to the prison to visit him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I can tell you that stuff. Anyways, so then you got the Rhythm of the Rain, number three, the Cascades. Number five, She's a Fool, Leslie Gore. So Leslie Gore is, you know, that's how Hal got into Batman, because Leslie Gore was Catgirl or whatever, not Catwoman, but Kitty or something. So you can see how he's playing connected with people. And he's still connected.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course, number one, Surf City, Jan and Dean. Now, this song is, listen to the drums and the bells and the cymbals on The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Bobby V. Number three, You're the Devil in Disguise, Elvis Presley. And then eight, Zippity-Doo-Dah, Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, another one of Spector's people. So, like, you know, I guess I just can't be going on and on and on here, but you can see how it's going.
Yeah, and a kicker of it. And actually, if you just look up on for just fun on Wikipedia, and I'm sure stuff is missing and wrong, but there's a list of recordings of songs that Hal Blaine has played on, which gives you it's A to Z, and you're scrolling and you're scrolling.
Yeah.
But a key thing to pay attention to is the diversity of styles of music. You just sit down and Hal will just read it, feel it, play on it, whatever it is. I mean, you've got songs where I think people would traditionally think that it would be, you know, an all African American group, but you've got a white Jewish guy playing drums, which you probably would never guess. He can fit into anything, which is just, that's and a like serious skill.
1964, I won't name the names, but I'll name the groups. These are all top 10s. Jay and the Americans, the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, the Beach Boys, Dean Martin, the Ripcords, the Beach Boys, Roy Orbison, the Hondells, little Honda, Jan and Dean, little old lady from Pasadena, Daddy Double Drum with Earl Palmer. Note for note. Mountain of Love, Johnny Rivers, the Marquettes, one of those, you know, you'd see those albums out with instrumentals, Out of Limits, Lauren Green and Ringo, Dean Martin, The Door Is Still Open, And then in 1965, he would win his first song of the year. When nowadays they have Grammys for everything. Hal used to say that Grammy for this, Grammy for that. So in my days, there was one. And he hit it in 1965 with A Taste of Honey by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass.
Yeah. He won six total, I believe.
In a row. Yeah. In a row. I can close my eyes and I can say every one of them. It's just fantastic that he did. But so every year it starts climbing. He's got more number ones. He's got more in 64. He's got more in 65. 1966. I mean, the Association, the Beach Boys, the Mamas and Papas, Bob Lynn, the Beach Boys, the Sandpipers, Simon and Garfunkel, Nancy Sinatra, Simon and Garfunkel, Petula Clark, Mamas and Papas, Bobby Aaron, Mamas and Papas, Petula Clark, the T-Bones, Johnny Rivers, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, the Beach Boys, Frank Sinatra, Nancy Sinatra, Beach Boys. Those are all 10,
it's wild. But one thing that I think could stand for maybe clarification for people who don't know, how this stuff would work. How does one man do all this? Is he invited by the artist typically?
Producers.
Like one producer would maybe work with five producers. Of these artists.
This is what happens. It was the producers. And Hal said he only ran into trouble once from one drummer. It was Michael Clark with the E on the Birds. And he approached Hal in the studio, very upset. And he approached him. And Clark was a gangly kind of tall guy, right? But he was very upset. And
he wanted to play drums on his...
Yep. As long as Terry Melcher, the Worst Day's Son, and the producer of Paul Revere and the Raiders for a while, and producer for the Birds, as long as Terry would lose those jobs to Bones Howe because these guys like the Birds wanted to play on their own songs. And only Jim McGuinn back then, Jim McGuinn was allowed to play on Mr. Tambourine Man. He was the only non-whatever. So what happened is that once Terry Melcher was replaced, they started playing it on their own records. It takes them 100 times, 300 takes to do a song, right? I won't name some of the songs, but Hal can tell you, whatever. So, is the producers. It wasn't the musicians. And a lot of times the drummer would come in and sit beside him. And, and then Hal would start throwing bones out too. As I said, Jim Gordon would be with him. Mike Nesmith's first song on the first Monkees record, Papa Jean's Blues. You had Hal Blaine and Jim Gordon and a guy named Gary Coleman, and not the little guy on the TV show. He was a big, tall guy with curly hair, blonde guy, a fantastic percussionist. So those guys would run as a team sometimes. Sometimes you see drums and percussion, Hal Blaine and Jim Gordon.
I mean, it sounds like a whole trust thing of, like you said, it would take people 300 takes. You think, why not, let the band do it. They worked hard. They're churning out these hits. I mean, this was a different time than today where bands can take, you rent studio space, you go. I mean, these are like, they're just knocking hits out. And for Hal to do it, learn it, play it, be done in an hour, it's the peace of mind for the producer.
Yeah, union contracts. I've had a lot of the contracts. Hal sent me photocopies, and I'll tell you, you call them in America social insurance numbers, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you call it?
Social security.
You could see all the guys and where they lived. A lot of them lived what they call NoHo, North Hollywood, and that area. And they lived 5 minutes from the studios and had still on their social security numbers what they got paid. And if Hal was a contractor, he got paid more. And then they were always signed by the head of Warner Brothers or the head of Columbia, and then they'd be the head of Columbia, and down below would be Terry Melcher, producer, Hal Blaine, musical contractor. So he got more. I mean, in 1962, Hal told me he was making $200,000 a year living in a mansion, and he told me he made it. He says he loved Jan Berry, he loved Jan and Dean, and Jan was going to be a doctor. He was going to medical school. He just loved him. And he says, one time we were up swimming in his pool, Jan's pool, overlooking the city. And he says, when I overlooked that city and I was hanging out with Jan Berry, I knew I had made it. And he told me that. That was one thing when he said, I knew I had made it.
Hey guys, I'm excited to announce I just became a partner with Drumeo, and I can now offer a free 30-day trial of Drumeo to my listeners and viewers, and I think you guys are going to really like it. Find the link in my description for a free 30-day trial of Drumeo. That's cool to know that, because they're like I said before, there seems to be just, like, sometimes you have those explosive moments. He's going gig to gig to gig to gig, and, yeah. And there's not much time to reflect on it, it seems like, but that's neat for him to say, I've made it, because he really is like the epitome of like Hollywood 50s, 60s musician, gigs all day long, going hopping around. I mean, you know, 7 or 8 gigs a day is what I think I heard him say at one point. 12 drum sets. They're all set up in different places.
And it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened without Ricky Fauché.
Okay. Which we also need. So where does his, you know, famous drum tech, your friend, and
1964.
That's when Ricky comes in.
1964. He had already been Ricky, just amazing, amazing person. You read his story. I mean, near the end of Ricky's life, the Ken Burns people, they were interested in Ricky.
Oh, wow.
Because it's not about music. It was about stock car racing. Ken Burns wanted to do something about racing in America. And Ricky was an expert. He was a small man. He was like only weighed about 100 pounds, but he was wiry and strong. And what happened is that he was working for a lot of different types of people, including Wally Hyder, the great Wally Hyder. In fact, a little side story, they went out and did a show at Sam Giancana's restaurant, bar, nightclub outside of Chicago in Des Plaines. And it was a gangster town, as Ricky said. He used those words, gangster town, okay? And he said, the Rat Pack were coming. It was Sinatra, Dino, probably Joey Bishop, no Sammy, because we're talking.
Yeah.
They didn't want him in the club.
That time,
let's just say
yes.
The way it was.
Sure.
So anyways, they were there. They were doing a show, and they were all there. And from there, Sinatra was there. And, you know, Mr. Giancana was one of the most, a big, big shot in America, no doubt of it. He was connected, right? So anyways, once he gets back and he's working for another guy that started he had a drum cartage company. And there was an old man that first started, and then another guy took over. And then what happened is Hal wanted to hire him. And because Hal used the same company, and they would drop the drums off the wrong place, the wrong studio, outside the studio, down the hall. And Hal said it took one day of going through all the line pullers and everything. And he said, I got to get me a guy. And so he did. Ricky got a call. He went into somewhere and somebody said, Hal Blaine wants you in Studio 3 there and wants you to go and meet him. And he goes, Hal Blaine, who's he? But Ricky went and met him. And from there on, they had a great friendship. Without Rick Fauché, I know Hal would say this, he would have had the career, but he might not have had as long as he had to schlep all those drums around. And Ricky just started off. Hal said, we'll get you a van and we got you a public utility license, whatever, to drive my gear around. And Ricky always told me we had no name on the gear or on the van, nothing. Always keep it quiet. Don't advertise, because we had drums in there. And he said it took Ricky an hour or two to learn Hal's setup, that Hal was 10 years of every, you know, the way the cymbals are tilted.
Experimenting.
And off they went. And in fact, on the day before A Taste of Honey was made, Ricky had Hal's drums, always at his house. He lived in Sunland outside, a nice little town. And anyways, and Ricky also lived in LA too. But he had Hal's, he started pulling off the front rim and took off the tension rods. And he said, I bet you they rattle in there. And so what he did is he started stuffing them with cotton. The phone rang. Rick, it's Hal, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, downbeat with Herb. Ricky goes, oh my God, it's 3 a.m. So, I mean, but he's a guy who'd get up at 5. So he put the cotton in all, took the drum apart, put it all in there, showed up with the drums. Herb was there. Hal was there. The drums were set up. And I think he had already set the drums up and was going somewhere else, but he came back to make sure. And he says he watched Hal, a little bit nervous. And he said Hal never fiddled around with stuff because Ricky had it right dialed in. You remember, they had calfskin heads on the bass drums, you know, and front and back. And so Hal sometimes would just do a little twitch, and Ricky was just watching. He realized Hal didn't catch on, and he left. And then came that taste of honey, and that's on that drum. So it just, he was always ahead of Hal. He had, you know, always, they had a couple of sets, always on the go. And Hal's cymbals, Ricky carried, and Hal never carried anything. In fact, when the Monster set came, Hal went from one studio from Columbia to another one across the street, and he rolled them across in the crosswalk because he had them on wheels. I mean, that's wow. The Monster sets are a whole different art, you know, the art form. He built them for Ringo, he built them for Harrison and all that. But the first set was built by Howie Oliver at Pro Drum. And what happened is that Ricky was in there, and Hal was so excited. He wouldn't let Ricky wanted to do his magic to him. And Hal said, "No, I want those drums tomorrow morning. Set them up. I got to play them." And Hal went in, was fiddling around with them. And the engineer said to Ricky, "I can hear stuff, vibrations. And they're coming from, you know, from here." And Ricky goes, "That's why." So he had to take the drums back and put all the cotton in the Monster sets as well. You know, brass bolts, cotton, nothing moves around. Hal's floor toms, they had little rubber tips on them, and Ricky made the legs for Hal's size. They always set up the way, and he used lock tights. The drums are all over my house, Hal's drums. The set that Ricky made for me, the 65 Blue Sparkle, cloned Hal's with that. Jim Keltner helped us get the calfskin heads. I mean, but it's just works of art, masterpieces.
Yeah, because, well, and I've heard, so Ricky described as basically the first drum tech, you know, to be needed, really, because before that, you know, you carry your own gear, you do this stuff, but the sheer amount of work that Hal was doing required that help, like you just described. Oh. I mean, the jumping around from place to place where, you, like you said, it made his career last longer, because otherwise he would have gotten burnt out. He would have maybe hurt himself just moving stuff. His skills could be utilized better drumming. And then you have Ricky being kind of the mad scientist, opening things up and stuffing things in there and making it work.
I'll tell you, the most famous British drummer was Bobby Graham. People don't know who he is. Bobby Graham. Bobby Graham played all the Dave Clark 5 stuff. Dave Clark doesn't like that. You know, he didn't play it. Bobby Graham. And he played a lot of the big Kink songs too. Bobby Graham played 15,000 songs, tracks in 10 years in Britain. He's from London. He's from North London. He's one of my heroes. He died at 69. He just wore out. But anyways, him and Hal kept in touch a bit. And Bobby said, "Hal, if I had had that young guy of yours, I would have lived longer." Because with Bobby Graham, they drove a small British car with his Carlton big 26-inch bass drum and going into the British studios and all that stuff. And he says it was to do 6 gigs, it ruined him. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that was the difference. I mean, Hal could have been a Bobby Graham. Bobby burned out in 10 years. 10 years, 15,000. Doo-wah, diddy, all the British stuff, all the British invasion with another gentleman named Clem Cattini, who did a lot of stuff too. Yep. All the British invasion was these two guys.
Yeah. I mean, just the sheer, good for Hal for knowing, for recognizing that and just saying, "I need help." Okay, he got help. Great. And then, you know, Ricky sounds like the perfect guy for it. Let's talk about the Wrecking Crew a little bit. Maybe explain kind of what it is, who they are, you know, briefly, and then talk about Hal's amazing time with them.
The Wrecking Crew had come from, there were actually a couple of dozen. And they were formed into little kind of rhythm groups and as well. So with guitars and basses, back then stand-up basses too. And, you know, what they were, there were guys like Billy Strange that came from Texas, the guy who produced Strangers in the Night, you know, a lot of Nancy stuff, you know, just all the producers, a little like Lee Hazlewood would hire, the great Lee Hazlewood, you know, a battle veteran in Korea, battle veteran. Think of that, would hire Hal and all that kind of stuff. And like, so what happened is that they would, there were kind of guys that, because the guys before them, before Patty Page's husband started getting these guys on a lot of stuff as well, they were wearing shirts and ties and they were wearing suits and sitting in the metal chairs or whatever. And they looked down and suddenly some of these young guys coming in, younger than them. I mean, this is what happened. And a great guitar player named Jerry Cole, like on Beach Boy stuff, Wouldn't It Be Nice? You hear two guitar, two 12 strings, and then Hal comes in and Frankie Capp joins them on the timpani. You know what I mean? So it was all these guys. They came from different places around the globe around the country, and they all lived there because guess what? They didn't wear ties. I mean, I'll tell you, Hal didn't. We went to Nashville years later. Hal, it was cold in December, November. Hal didn't bring any socks or pants.
California guy.
Exactly. Okay. So, Gary Puckett and Union Gap, which Jim Gordon did play some of the songs. Hal played the others. It was done with the band and the professional singers and the horns all at once. Boom. You know.
A lot of pressure, yeah, but these guys pressure, just knocked it out. Yeah.
But Hal would tell jokes. Some of them are, you know, very colorful language. I mean, sure. Being a Catholic boy, I know all about that. And so anyways,
I mean, Carole Kay, the famous bassist, early female musician, obviously she deserves a lot of credit, but she said they would be called sometimes the First Call Gang.
Yeah.
It's just a group of just phenomenal musicians who would just run the studio scene. I mean, and there's a great documentary, which most people have seen, but there's a great Wrecking Crew documentary. But I mean, Glenn Campbell, a lot of great musicians, they're all icons. But I always thought when I heard Glenn Campbell was in the Wrecking Crew, you know, however many years ago that I first heard it, I was just thinking, man, you don't know. There's so much history to this group of people.
Everybody loves somebody. I have a guy I know. He's the son of the bass player, the stand-up bass player. And he was there as a kid. And everybody loves somebody. And he was there as a kid. He was watching. And he met Dean Martin and all that kind of stuff. And anyways, he said the musicians came in and the musical director said, Glenn Campbell's coming. He doesn't read music. He doesn't write music. Hum him. Hum. And that's what they did. And the kid told me, in comes this good looking guy with a buckskin coat and all that kind of stuff, and blonde hair and apple cheeks and with a bunch of guitars, and everybody's giving him the look and all that stuff. And then the MD for Dean Martin there started going, and he just started, it's this or it's that, Glenn, or it's this or it's that, making noises. And it's just, you know, just killer. I mean, he was the man. He was, you know, and then, of course, he would go replace Brian in 1964 in the Beach Boys. Mm. I mean, and play bass.
Yeah. Seriously talented guy. And has his own massive career. I mean, that's huge. But and then the playing with Phil Spector and all that. I feel like Phil Spector has his own whole wild story that everyone needs to hear. But and you can Google it, and I'm sure, I think there's movies about that. But I heard an interesting story that Hal was saying about, I didn't realize at the time where, you know, before Phil, you know, it all happened with the shooting and all that stuff. Hal's daughter, Michelle, was Phil Spector's like right hand woman in that case. Yeah. And I guess went to work one day and was like, Dad, there's police all over the. You know, the castle, I guess is what they called it.
Yep, the castle.
Something like that. So I didn't realize his daughter was working with Phil Spector. It's pretty cool.
Well, yes. And what happened is during the NAMM show, you know, NAMM there in LA and the summer one in Nashville, I went out from Nova Scotia and I actually, you know, I stayed with Hal. Hal had said to me, he couldn't make it in for the NAMM show because he didn't feel well. And so he said, Mike, well, before he had changed his mind, he had said to me, we're going to have lunch at Phil's at the castle. And his chauffeur is going to come pick us up. He mentioned the name of the chauffeur. So I thought, wow, this is big. So, but I mean, once you're around Hal, like, I don't need any drug. I don't need any alcohol. I don't, the high that I had around Hal was, but I felt at peace because he was at peace. He knew he could trust me. He told me a lot of stuff. And, you know, Hal had a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, he was married many times and all that. But, like, I felt always at peace with him, even though I knew I was standing beside somebody, you know, they loved him and all that stuff. And I'm sure there was some jealousy, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all great on paper or, you know, in an hour and a half conversation or whatever. But I'm sure other drummers and just musicians, well, people are jealous.
They wouldn't play Frank Sinatra's drummer. I won't mention his name, but he would not play rock and roll. And so this is like in 1960 in that. So already these guys aren't playing it. Shelly Mann, I shouldn't say, you know, names, but a lot of guys.
Hal mentioned Shelly Mann in his interview and said, yeah, Shelly Mann said
he
wouldn't play.
No, we're not playing that stuff. It's gonna fall apart. It'll be gone and all that. And Hal and some of the other guys played in those studios in central LA. I mean, guys, the money they made. I mean, the Mamas and Papas stuff in 65 or Mr. I mean, Hal's making, as musical contractor, he's making $300-$400 on the 3-hour session. You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, yeah. What did people make? I mean, I know what my dad made back then.
Living exorbitantly. I mean, but he's hardworking, but he, from what I've heard of him talk about it, I mean, he would say that he could leave, he could make thousands and thousands of dollars a day, you know, in the later years, just cranking out these sessions. But he very openly talked about his divorce that cleaned him out and kind of put an end to his, his lifestyle for a while. He talked about having to sell his car that was, I guess, a 1927 or something, Rolls Royce, that he said he bought from Warner Brothers, I think. Yeah. It was in a bunch of movies, and it just broke his heart. His yacht he had to sell. I guess he said he sold his house to Gary Oldman, the actor, and then he said Ben Stiller bought it. Yes. He's a drummer,
that was
which I didn't really realize.
That was the Lee J. Cobb mansion.
Yeah, exactly, that you mentioned before. Yeah.
California divorce, cleaned out many of them.
Yeah, I mean, Hal was seriously like, he did not, there was no hiding how he felt. I mean, he got cleaned up.
California divorce, they can take your income for years down the road.
That's what he said, yeah.
And yeah. I know the girl he's talking about, I won't talk about her or anything like that.
Sure.
I know she was 6 foot tall and had platinum silver hair, platinum silver blonde hair. You know, he was with John Denver. And so the thing is, during the heydays of the 60s, I mean, he's got in 1966 and 1967, he started getting, he must have 20, there might be 45 hits in those 2 years.
Wow.
Top tens. Things started quieting down around the 70s, but not as much. Maybe in the mid 70s, it started quieting down, let's say in the studio. And definitely did. And so he took the job with John Denver. He had played on a bank commercial. And John Denver was a singer. And John Denver remembered him, how Hal's attitude was, how funny he was, and the whole thing. And years later, you know, he called him. And it was the same as the Carpenters. Once he got in with the Carpenters, I mean, that was it. Hal's the one who said to Mr. and Mrs. Carpenter, you know, your daughter has to stand up front and sing. No, we want her to play drums. No, he said, no, I'll play drums. You get her to sing because you can't be miming on TV playing drums and singing, right?
No.
Doesn't look right.
She's a phenomenal drummer. Oh. We all know that. I mean, she's Karen Carpenter's unbelievable. Now, when did you become involved? I know you've kind of mentioned this before, but when was your involvement? When did you get involved with Hal?
When Hal moved up to the Northern California, I always bought Modern Drummer. I have tubs and tubs and tubs of them. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I don't think they even make Modern Drummer. All the magazines I wrote, they might have it online, but all the magazines I wrote for, they're all gone. And so anyways, I saw Hal wrote in. He would write in. Of course, I read all his Staying in Tune, all his tips for kids and for drummers through the years. So anyways, I looked through it. I saw the Hal's drums were for sale. Wow. Wow. And not only that, for the Modern Drummers, I had the Modern Drummer from May or April 1981, and the Hal Blaine's John Denver set was on the cover with Hal. And so I had it for years. I still had the original one. And I'd stare at that set, and I'd stare at the tape on the that went from beneath the rim to the just to the top of the head. And I'd tear it out as I would just analyze. And so he had the four-piece drum set with a matching snare, and he had matching congas for the John Denver show. And then he had them for sale. And, you know, he had that and a big Pearl set. My wife and I discussed it. One set was a little bit more than the other one. And we decided, I said, geez, that Pearl set looks nice. It had Hal Blaine Strikes Again on it and all that. And I just thought to myself, oh, my God, but there's the John Denver set. And it was a lady named Rockin' Rita Walters. She had a used drum store in Santee, S-A-N-T-E-E, in outside San Diego. And there was no computer. There was fax machine. It was about the end of 1996. And my wife said, got to go for these, you know what I mean? And, you know, we were paying for education and stuff like this and good school. So I went up to the bank with the pictures on the magazine. And they were going to give me a loan anyways, right? But I took a loan. Here's my collateral. And they go, oh, my God. And I said, and look at this, whatever, this set here. So, yeah, I think we had a line of credit. Maybe they extended it. So I bought the drums. Rita was just fantastic. Her husband was fantastic. And she was selling the drums with no commission and giving everything to Hal, and including free shipping to me. So that was nice.
That's nice.
Because, yeah. Boy, is it ever expensive nowadays. Yeah. And so anyways, I talked to Hal through her, but I had been writing it, so he knew I was a bit, and so off they came, and they arrived, and from then on we were good friends. And then from there, I bought other drums from her, his Black Beauty from the late 70s with a Slingerland throw off on it, made by one of Hal's later day drum techs when Ricky left the scene. And his Black Beauty that he used in a Jingle House, and his, when he was with Pearl, they gave him a one-piece maple. Oh, just like a beautiful, both 6.5 by 14s too, deep snares. And I got that as well. And Hal, I've got pictures, all the heads are signed, all the John Denver stuff. That's the set I bought, the John Denver set.
Which is very cool.
Somebody asked me, did Hal ever change heads? No. His heads, the John Denver heads, are just black and, you know, just in that circle, right? And all that stuff. And then later on, I would buy, we did a deal. There's a drum builder named Ray Ayotte, and from Canada. He builds beautiful drums. He got involved with Thai drums, which are from, Taiwan. We said, so we worked out a deal, and Hal got two sets. And Hal and Ricky drove to Chino, California, to the Thai factory. And Ray picked out some good ones. And one is a dark blue that's on the cover of Vintage Drummer, and now is Classic Drummer. And listen, I put them up against DWs. They're just as good. I don't care what anybody says. They're great drums for the amount of money. You paid $2,500, and you got a nice set of top line. And that was a big deal with Hal. I don't want those drums expensive and all that stuff. And he loved them. Ricky set them all up. He did, of course, his Ricky stuff. Ray said to me, "Oh my God, Mike," he said. He says, he wants to start pulling stuff. I said, "Let him do whatever he wants.
He knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing."
Yeah.
I mean, Ricky was the Yamaha guy's Haggy, Mr. Haggy, the guy that designed the 9000. He met with Ricky. The Tama guys met with Ricky.
Oh, wow.
And to see Hal's stuff. And they copied. I mean, whether they gave Ricky $100 here and there or whatever, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So, I mean, that's where a lot of that came from.
Let's talk about the monster kit that you were referring to before, which is basically designed. It's not the prettiest drum set in the world. I mean, we love it because we think it's beautiful. But you know what I mean? You're not looking at a Black Oyster Pearl Ludwig set that's just designed. It's meant for a studio. It's meant to be on wheels. It's meant to be like... for recording. It's not for giant stage shows. So just tell us about what it is and the makeup of it.
Where it came from is this. Hal had two Gretsch timbales. I've had them in my hands, as I said, at his house. And they were real brass. I mean, nothing dinky that they make nowadays. Real brass. And they're in the box that said Patty Page Show. Okay. So what Hal used to do is he put one. He could, you know, he had a workshop. His father was a worker type of guy. Hal had a workshop, and he put an L arm from a Ludwig on the, I think it was a 13 and a 14, maybe. The timbales were 13 and 14, let's say. And he put an L arm on the smaller one and put it on his Blue Sparkle bass drum with the Ricky's all the connections for the tom-toms, they're all made of stainless steel and they're all one piece. They weren't, you know, you're doing that. They just fit on and they never moved. So he took the timbale, the bigger timbale, and he put floor tom legs on it from Ludwig's. So he had that there and that there set up with a set. And what happened is he detuned them to get the decay, you know, because timbales, you know, maybe you're down in super Jamaica high or something. They're a little whatever. And so he detuned them. And he said the first time he took them to Terry Melcher fell on the floor of the studio, rolled around, and almost died. And from then on, it was bring the timbale set and all that. And that's what they were. They were detuned. One-headed, he got the idea and started talking to Howie Oliver, who worked for Pro Drum. I mean, you know, just another genius. But, and what happened is Howie started making, there was a guy named Alan Blamar who lived in Eagle Rock area in LA. And he had worked for the US government in the Second World War as an engineer or sound guy or something, just a smart guy. And he had made this casing out of this material to go along the cables in the oceans. Hmm. So Alan Blamar lived in a house. He had a workshop, and he had all this stuff made out of
fiberglass.
And now, of course, in California, I mean, Ricky has something chrome plated for me on my clone set. He drove the Tijuana with it because they won't allow it in California. And I don't blame him. I don't blame them, right?
Because of the emissions and how bad it is for the environment and stuff.
Exactly. So in Tijuana, Ricky had drove it over, left it with the guy, had Ricky's name on it, and it came back instead of scabby rust, it was just mint. So anyways, so what happened is they have the fiberglass, and they were all, and Alan Blamar was making these, and then two and two together, they started building a set. Howie Oliver started, really built the sets, and at first, but then, as I said, Ricky had to do his thing on it. He had to make better stands. He took wheels off Klieg lights, you know, the big show lights.
Yeah, big like studio lighting that weighs a ton. Yeah.
Plus, Ricky would throw out, he took, even on the clone set he made for me, he took out all the screws from Ludwig, all of them, throw them in the, I heard him on the phone one day, I'd throw them in the garbage. And what he put is jet engine, because all the factories were there at the airport in LA, the Hughes, Howard Hughes' company, and they had just burns and burns of screws and this and titanium and all that. And Hal did, or Ricky did Hal's Swivelmatic pedals. And Dennis Wilson, who was a thrasher with those Beetle boots on, right? Yeah. You know, on the pedal. Same sure. thing. He could engineer everything. So he had all these parts. He just souped up all the drums, took all the noises out of them. And he even told me, he said, where the tom, the concert tom came off, the fiberglass tom, he said, I always had, where the arm goes, I had the Remo emblem there. So I knew when I grabbed it out of the whatever, or if it was still on, or I had to take it off for a reason, I knew I was going for the Remo thing. That's what Hal played. He only played Remo.
Sure.
So he had these sets, and he had two of them. And one would be used, and then maybe another go to another studio. Ed Sullivan had Nancy come out, and that's where they showed. First time on TV was on the Ed Sullivan produced show, 2 hour, I think an hour special with Nancy, and she had the drummer man Hal Blaine with him. I mean,
and he played these, and he played the Monster Kit.
The Monsters.
Wow, okay. On then that. I stand corrected where I said you wouldn't see him live or anything, but I mean, these things are, they're like engineered.
And one of the best things is, it, like, he recorded, the most songs he recorded for anybody was Andy Williams. 125 songs, something like that. I just read that on Ingrid's great Hal, and that's blessed by the Blaine family. Facebook. I just got on Facebook 2 months ago. So, you know, to me, there's so much information.
And that's a great page, and I'm glad you said that, because if you look on Facebook, it's, and I can put a link in the description, but if you look up Hal Blaine, it's the group. I mean, there's 7,000 members.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say her name wrong, but Ingrid Fashing.
Yeah. Something
Ingrid is doing a great
exactly.
job.
Exactly.
I want to end and say, first off, thank you for being on the show and sharing your time, because this is just like we had to do it. Thank you to Raphael Zimmerman for
thank you. I'm going to
getting us
going to send him a thank you. Yeah.
Yes, and he's just an awesome guy, and has consistently kind of poked me about this, which is what it takes to, because sometimes you got to find the perfect person, and after doing this for 2 hours now, you are definitely it. And as we wrap up, I want to read something that I heard Hal say on this interview earlier. He said, were you friends with Buddy Rich? And Hal said, we weren't really friends, we were acquaintances, you know, he knew Buddy. He said, but Buddy hired Hal to play on Kathy Rich's album. And everyone said, why would you not play on it, Buddy? And he said, I wanted the best
exactly.
to play on on Kathy Rich's album.
I mean,
Buddy Rich is your dad.
Yeah, exactly.
We got to say, I need to say this. Hal died March 11th, 2019 at the age of 90. Natural causes, very long, full life.
Full life.
Man. All right. Well, Mike, I mean, again, this has just been unbelievable having you here. I want to thank
I hope you enjoyed it.
Your stories. Oh, it's great. I mean, this is just, again, I think it's about the most firsthand source that you can get. So this has just been awesome, Mike. I appreciate you taking the time and sharing your knowledge.
Oh, thank you, Bart. Thank you for asking me. And thank you for letting me say something I always wanted to say about my friendship with Hal. It almost brings tears to my eyes, man.
Sure. Beautiful. Cool. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Bart.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History, and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.